Broadcasting live from our Westlake studios, overlooking the great city of Austin and helping you maneuver through this waning dystopia, it is another episode of Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. Coming up this hour at 12:45, the Crap Bag takes a look at what's going on in the NBA playoff. At 12:30, my goodness, what happened on the pitch over the weekend? One of the crazier and thankfully not more tragic moments in the history of sports. And in mere minutes, Texas is going back to Omaha. Longhorn Baseball takes care of their business this weekend in the Super Regional. And we have some recruiting updates from the 40 Acres as well. From the world of football, a little bit of basketball as well. I'm Trey Elling, and sitting across from me is not the Waxahachie native and level-headed Aggie. That's because Chad Hastings is on vacation this week. In his place for today up until 2 o'clock, it is my friend Joe Cook from Inside Texas. What's up, Joe? How you doing today?
Doing great. Running on a couple hours sleep, but pretty excited to be here.
It was a late one last night, but there was a good reason to be out late last night, and it had very little to do with doing shots with Occupy Left Field at the end of last night's game, apparently like Chris Del Conte did yesterday evening in celebration of the Longhorns making it to another College World Series.
Yeah, it was a party there. I was kind of surprised for Sunday at 8 p.m. that it had the crowd that it did, but once Cam Williams hit that two-run home run late, you could kind of sense that the whole stadium could sense, okay, this one's out of reach. And I think that was against one of USF's last really good arms. They didn't really have much bullpen depth. And once Cam hit that one over the center field fence, that's when everybody kind of realized it's time to start making travel plans to Nebraska.
I'll admit I stopped watching right after that. Did he get a sixth at bat? Did he end up going one for one with five walks and a homer?
He did not. We were kind of rooting for that up in the, and we don't cheer, but we kind of wanted to see some school history made, and it would be a school record tying fifth walk, but I think he either grounded out or struck out. But that's quite the stat line. You don't see one for one with, you know, four runs, four RBIs, I think, and four walks as well, one for two, I guess.
No doubt about that. We'll certainly get more into that game and also the first game of the weekend. Did also want to say hello to Zay, who is behind the glass today. Zay is going to be with me all week, including in the hosting chair on Wednesday, which I'm looking forward to Wednesday for that reason. But Zay, how was your weekend, man? Everything good on your end?
Yeah, everything was good. Great sports weekend.
I hear you got to go visit Hyatt Lost Pines on Friday when everybody was playing golf and actually partake in the lazy river.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Just really realized that I'm too big for the floats nowadays, which is very depressing. But, you know, I did my thing.
Were there too many kids in the pool when you were hanging out there?
No, there were a lot of adults. It was nice. It was a nice little vibe.
Yeah,
there are
well,
a couple kids, but there are a lot of adults, though.
Trust me, you were glad you weren't there 24 hours later. It was teeming with kids, most of whom had no idea what was going on around them. They were just having way too much fun in the pool. But thank you for hanging out with us all week, Zay.
Yeah, I got you.
So I was participating in the Mullet Open on Friday. That's why I wasn't on this program. And I think I've told both of you guys, I suck at golf. I am terrible at golf. I mean, it is embarrassing to watch me from hole to hole. But I actually had a couple of moments in this tournament that will, of course, lead me back to the course at some point in the next weeks, months, years, however long it's going to be. I hit a 30-foot putt for birdie that had a big bend in it, and then also a 15-foot putt as well that also helped my team get a birdie. Now, we finished even par for the day, so we wouldn't have been even par without me.
There you go.
And it just goes to show, this is something Chad was telling me about on Thursday, that if you can bring a little bit to the course with your putter, even if you suck at every other facet of the game, if you're in a scramble, you will have some value for your team.
Yeah, and that's the fun part of playing in a scramble is, you know, you can miss pretty much every shot, and I do that. Now, it sounds like you do that too, but yeah. if you're get it just that one time and you make that one putt or that one shot that helps the team out, you feel accomplished and you want to go out there and keep doing it and try and get better and continue to help, but it's not as easy as they make it look on TV.
No, it's not. It's still a lot of fun every year to get out there for the Mullet Open. Bucky does such a great job with that. Of course, helping to raise money for Refuge Ranch and Burke Center for Youth. And it was another successful event this year, the 20th year of the Mullet Open. Thanks to everybody who participated this year. And I have to say, as I was going through and talking to people on Friday, the buzz was not the golf tournament. It wasn't anything else going on except for Texas baseball. Of course, the first Texas game wasn't going to be until Saturday night. A couple of late starts on Saturday and Sunday. But in the end, Texas did what I think a lot of us expected them to do, and that was sweep this series. It was a best-of-three series. Didn't take today's game to decide who was going to Omaha. Texas got out to a little bit of a lead on Saturday night, lost it in the ninth inning, a dramatic home run hit by South Florida, but they did, Joe, and I know you titled a column, the going to back to the World Series column, as something along these lines. They did what they've done all year long, and that's deal with adversity, take the team's best shot, and then give their best shot, and ultimately come out victorious as a result.
Yeah, it was. You got to, first of all, I mean, Eric Kennedy's hit was phenomenal, and it's good to see that he's seeing the ball lately, because there's some other guys in the lineup who haven't, but that bottom of the order, basically 5 through 9, have done really well on offense. So you give Eric Kennedy a lot of credit for, you know, hitting a ball over a center fielder who was probably playing too far in. But at the same time, the at-bat before, Silas Ardoin grounds a ball to shortstop. He's not very fleet of foot. He's not the fastest guy, but he still hustles it out. The shortstop can't make the play, and that set up the game winner. So it's a team that doesn't really have a, you know, it's always cliche, and when you see a good team so often, it's easy to throw the cliches out. But they match them all. They are resilient. They do have really good pitching. They have good hitting, good defense. They respond. David Pierce talks about how they are basically their – you know, they have to get there early to help the guys because they're already there early. It's not like the coaches are saying, hey, be here at, you know, 8 a.m. The guys are there already at 8 a.m. So the coaches love being able to coach a team like that. And it's basically why last night there was a lot of emotion in David Pierce's voice. And it was, and, you know, he could tell, you could tell just how happy he was that this team made it as far as it did, because he's always been very forthright with us in the media and told us how he feels. Was very, very honest. And he was, again, same way last night, but there was the tone of his voice. You could just tell that there was a lot of emotion and how proud he was of that team that made it all the way to the final eight.
It's easy to take good defense for granted in baseball, but you watched how things played out both games this weekend. There was obviously Texas was just mashing the ball last night, and they were very patient, and South Florida pitchers were having a hard time hitting their spots, and that was really from the first inning on. But there were also defensive miscues that was allowing Texas more runners on base and more opportunities to score runs. And the same things happens in the bottom of the ninth on Saturday, where you get the error from the shortstop that leads to the game-winning run, whereas Texas is getting sterling defense all weekend out of the shortstop position.
Yeah, Trey Faltini, his bat has come on of late. That glove has been there all year, and it's been impressive to see. And there's a bit of string of over the past, you know, 8-9 years of really good shortstops who've played at Texas, including, you know, C.J. Hinojosa, David Hamilton. There was one year where there was a little bit of a gap, but, you know, Mason Hibler stepped in and did some good things there from time to time. But I don't know if there's been a better glove than what we've seen from Trey Faltini this year. He makes the routine look routine, and sometimes the spectacular look routine. And it's just been really fun to see. And his bat, it's been coming around lately. He's seen the ball, 2 doubles last night, drove in a few runs early, set the tone for the game. And like I said, he's just part of that 5 through 9 in the lineup that have really started to make an impact offensively, not just defensively.
Was there any concern in the press box when Texas found themselves down 2-0 after the top, or I'm sorry, after the bottom of the first yesterday, because South Florida was the home team?
It was a little out of character for Tristan Stevens, because if you remember, I think he walked 2 and hit a batter. So that's not his style of pitching. I don't think he even walked 20 batters all year. So for him to get 2 right there in the first inning and hit a batter, it was a little out of character. But when he went back to the mound the next time, he had a lead, and he pitched like he has with a lead and was efficient, attacked the zone, worked quickly, and kind of went back to normal. He didn't last as long as he normally does, only 5.2 innings, I think. But he did what they needed to do. There was plenty of run support by that point, and any concern about Stevens was kind of alleviated just by the offense being able to do what it does.
No question about that. Also love the defensive play that he made coming off the mound to catch the squeeze guy at home.
Yeah, if you watch that play, it was a safety squeeze, but Cam Williams was back, Zach Zubia was back. The only person who was going to be able to make a play at the plate like that was Tristan Stevens, and he did everything perfectly in order to make that play at the plate.
He sure did. So Texas obviously makes it to another College World Series. I believe this is their 37th trip to Omaha, which is the most all-time. It's their first since 2018. I think it's their 10th since the turn of the century. What is your expectation for this team right now? We talked to you last Monday, Joe, and look, you're a journalist. You try and stay as even keel as possible. I'm a guy who demands opinions out of people, so I finally got you to admit, yeah, it would be a little bit disappointing if Texas didn't make it to the College World Series this year. They have now, so is a championship a realistic possibility for them? Do they at least need to win one game here for you to feel pretty good about this trip up to Nebraska?
I think that's a good way to put it, but you know, with the way the things have shaken out, look at their side of the bracket. They're either going to get, I think, either Virginia or DBU. So those are two quality teams, but they're not national seeds. They're not hosts. Tennessee, who may be one of the hottest teams in the country right now with the way they're swinging the bat. And then their first round game is either going to be Notre Dame or Mississippi State. And of course, when you're at this point, they're all good. You know, if you make it to the Final Eight, if you make it to Omaha, it's because you're playing good baseball at the right time and most likely have been doing so all year. But, you know, we can look at, oh, Tennessee's hot. Oh, DBU or Virginia's hot. Oh, Notre Dame. Texas. I mean, look at them. They won the Big 12. They have not lost a postseason game yet. I don't think it's unrealistic to think that they have a really good shot of making it and winning a national championship. And even Tristan Stevens and David Pierce were talking about that. They're not, you know, I think in 2018, they weren't happy to be there. But, and I don't think the team thought this way, but there was a sense basically from everybody following that this isn't a team that's built to win here. And that's, of course, when they went up against Arkansas and then faced, I think, Brady Singer in Florida and got eliminated, that bore out pretty quickly. But this is a team with, you know, three ace quality guys. They have a good lineup up and down that has some holes right now, but it has had holes all year. And they have a really good defense, and they're going to a pitcher's park. So, you know, any long ball issues or anything like that is going to be alleviated also by your great defensive outfield. So, you know, we can talk about like, oh, this team can do this. Oh, this team can do this. But at a certain point, you have to say, hey, Texas has been doing this all year. And I think they have as strong a chance, you know, in a while to make a run and potentially walk away with number 7.
So David Pierce flip-flopped his regular season weekend rotation for the regional, having Tristan Stevens pitch first, Ty Madden pitch second, goes back to Madden, then Stevens for this weekend series. Do you think that's what he sticks with when the games start up this weekend?
You know, I'm really not sure. A lot of the reason behind Stevens starting that regional was because as a former reliever, has the ability to, if you need an inning on maybe Monday or, you know, whenever, he could come back and pitch maybe one inning, maybe one, two innings, something like that.
Did his ability to hold runners on facing that Texas Southern team, did that factor into it as well?
It may have as well, but I think the primary reason was being able to respond. Of course, these guys, you know, in between outings, they are pitching, they are throwing. They may not be, they're not throwing in live games with heavy implications, but they are throwing. And of course, those are different. But I you know, I'm not sure it really is up to David Pierce at that point. It's a good problem to have, considering you have two first-team all-conference guys as your options. And then, oh, yeah, Pete Hansen's right there behind you. So if you're asking me, I would probably do whatever best sets you up whenever, if you make it to that championship series, to have your number one guy going. I'm not sure what that strategy looks like, but either way, it's tough to go wrong with who they have available.
So Texas did most of their damage last night without really getting much production from the middle of the order. Is that becoming a bit of a concern for you at all, specifically Ivan Melendez? It seems like he is inside his own head right now and really having a hard time figuring things out.
Yeah, I'm not concerned about Zach Zuby. I think that, I mean, he extended his reach base streak. He's always been a patient hitter, which is, you know, something that you don't see from a guy with his power very often. He's always been a patient guy, not afraid to take walks. Zach, it kind of seems like he's fastball hunting. And, you know, as a power hitter, as a guy like that, it's good to do. You know, if you're going to put the ball over the fence, it's usually from fastball. But it seems like teams have attacked him with low and away breaking stuff, and he has not been able to respond. I mean, he had a bad Big 12 tournament to where he was pulled ahead of the elimination game. He hasn't done well, particularly well in the regional outside of his home run, I believe. And he didn't really do well against South Florida. It was good to see that before David Pierce did give Peyton Powell an opportunity, that he did get a base hit, pulled one through the left side. That's, you know, obviously a little bit of a confidence booster, but that's kind of the main concern that I was talking to earlier about the lineup right now, is that Ivan is just not, he's just not seeing the ball, and he's not seeing the breaking stuff, and it's affecting how the rest of the lineup goes. But luckily, 5 through 9 has been picking things up for him and alleviating the issue a little bit.
So that was the biggest news on the 40 acres this weekend, but there was also a lot else happening, specifically with football and hosting a camp, and then also a number of official visits as well, because recruiting has finally opened back up now. We are through that level of COVID, so it was a bit of a chaotic weekend in the football offices and at DKR too. What are some of your most profound takeaways from this weekend for Steve Sarkisian and company?
It sounds like it was a home run, and a lot of these guys, a lot of these juniors, it was their first experience, you know, being able to see Austin and see the program under Steve Sarkisian. They had, you know, there had been some outreach by Tom Herman's staff, but 2023, at least for that staff, was still really early. So you're seeing a lot of these guys coming to Austin for the first time, meeting a lot of these coaches for the first time, and we were able to talk to a few of them once they were able to leave campus, including DeSoto's Jonte Cook. And he was, you know, one of the things that, you know, we explain in our inside scoop on Inside Texas is, you know, just basically what all these guys' takeaways are. And when I was able to talk to Jonte Cook, one of his takeaways was that Arch Manning, Cooper's son, Peyton and Eli's nephew, the hype is real. They were able to get some work done inside DKR. And I don't know if you saw, there was a throw that made its way around social media of Arch just launching one. And the way Jonte described it, he goes, you know, he was from the 30 and he hit me on the X in the end zone. So that's the hype is real. But Jonte, when I talked with him, he came down to see what it would be like to be coached here. That's what a lot of these kids go when they go to camps. They want to see what their future position or future head coach, how he interacts with his players. And, you know, he's one of the better wide receivers in the 2023 class. And he worked out with Andre Coleman. And he said, you know, I was really happy to see what his coaching style was like. And another thing is, we kind of know how Tom Herman's personality was. It was a little bristly, and you know, that came across in a lot of facets. And of course, you know, there's, when you're recruiting, you're trying to be your best self, and he was able to do that pretty well. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. The impression I got from some of the other kids that I talked to who went to that was that, you know, there's a very California cool vibe with Steve Sarkisian. Like a very, you know, he knows his stuff. He's not going to get real amped and charged up. He's not going to, you know, be super in your face. He's going to do what he thinks knows is going to work and believe it and trust it.
He's not going to headbutt his own helmeted players to try and inspire them before a conference game.
I like that. I did. I don't know why. It was.
Wait a second. You like that if it's the strength and conditioning coach, maybe if it's the defensive coordinator, depending on that guy's persona. You can't have your head coach doing that, though.
If Texas was 9-1 going into that game and Tom Herman was doing that, I think everybody would be a little bit on board. And you know, it was what it was. That was a pretty embarrassing game up in Waco, but I find that kind of entertaining.
Okay, that's fair. Texas also did get a commitment this weekend. We talked to your IT colleague, Justin Wells, on Wednesday, and I asked him if he expected a commitment at some point this week, and he said no, but there's no telling when you get a gathering like this, and sure enough, a guy does pop. Anthony Jones, another out-of-state recruit, class of 2020. He plays his high school ball in Vegas, and at least for right now, it looks like he'll be playing his college ball here in Austin. What can you tell us about Anthony Jones?
Yeah, he was on his official visit, I believe, this weekend, or one of his official visits, or unofficial. He made his way to Austin. That's, yeah. I know that for sure. Was previously committed to Washington, and that was when Pete Kwiatkowski was at Washington back at that time. Stepped away from that back in February, I believe, and Miami, so Manny Diaz and Oregon, they were interested in Anthony Anthony Jones, and Texas got him on his official visit. And I remember, I think during like the sixth inning of the Saturday game, I started seeing a bunch of the coaches and recruiting staffers start posting cryptic things on social media, which kind of may, on an official visit weekend, kind of indicate something. And, you know, a few minutes later, Jones committed. He's a little bit underrated by the services. He's a three-star guy on the composite and rated as, you know, number 11th player in Nevada. But, you know, he's a guy who, you look at his frame, 6'5", 240 something. He in his film shows a lot of off the ball linebacker, but he's probably going to be a guy who can play a variety of linebacker roles, including some of the edge ones for Pete Kwiatkowski's defense.
6'5", 242. That's pretty tall for a linebacker, but much like Steve Sarkisian and his quarterback recruits, I'm going to trust Kwiatkowski when it comes to guys that he is recruiting specifically at linebacker.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think off the ball's in his future. I think he does project either that X or that Jack spot, but you know, he's a guy that they – like you mentioned, I think that's a good way of putting it. You can kind of trust Pete Kwiatkowski at this point because of his track record working with those guys, and hope that he and Jeff Choate and Bo Davis can get the most out of this guy.
Back to Arch Manning for a second. Are IT posters, are they done with Quinn Ewers at this point? Are they ready to get on the Arch Manning train?
There's a contingent who, I mean, I saw someone made a post over the weekend, and it's very rational. It's like, look, you go after both. You want both. You understand both. It would be a tough grab. But, you know, it seems like after that visit to Clemson, after that visit to Texas, it seems like Texas is very much standing out for Arch Manning. And a lot of that has to do with Steve Sarkisian. I don't know if that would have continued. You know, I like Tom Herman's headbutting, but I don't know if the other thing would have, if recruiting would have continued after that. But, you know, has really made an impact on this recruitment, and I think it has to do not only with his demeanor and how he coaches, but also that offense. I think that has made a massive impact on the recruitment, and it's something that had, you know, Cooper in Austin. I think it was Archie, the grandfather, who was in Austin too. I don't know all the Mannings by facial recognition, but I think he was there in Austin on the visit as well.
He is Joe Cook of Inside Texas, hanging out today all the way up until 2 o'clock. Plenty more Longhorn baseball to be discussed. We will also get back into recruiting in a little bit when Jerry Hamilton joins us at 1 o'clock to give a further breakdown of Steve Sarkisian, his coaching staff, and all the players that they spoke with and worked out over the weekend, and some of the best news to come from all of that. Coming up next, though, a tragedy happened on the soccer field over the weekend, until all of a sudden it wasn't anymore. We'll talk about that coming up next year on Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. Mine is Chad Hastings on the Horn.
Shirts and Skins.
Man, back here on Shirts and Skins, no Chad Hastings today. He is on vacation all week, well-deserved. Joe Cook filling in today. Got a rotating cast of characters helping me co-host over this next week. That does include Justin Wells from Inside Texas on Friday. Kevin Dunn will be with me on Thursday. On Wednesday, Zay's going to be here in studio. And tomorrow, it's going to be a combination of Bucky Godbolt, Jeff Ward, and then at 2 o'clock, I'm having a conversation with Chris Del Conte. He'll be calling in for a few minutes, so looking forward to that. The success that Texas Athletics, Joe, have had just in this semester is enough to fill an athletic director's like career at a school. But Chris Del Conte has had this success in a single semester, a lot of it within the last 2 months, too, and it's not done yet. Now that Texas is making it back to the College World Series, is a chance for another national championship before it's all said and done.
Yeah, he started off with, this semester at least, started off with Eddie Reese, you know, number 15, getting that done, then retiring. Women's golf made a great run. Rowing wins the national title. Track and field has a good showing at nationals, including Tara Davis setting some more records. And then, of course, even women's basketball made that run to the Elite Eight under Vic Schaefer. Now softball, super regional run. I have all the list of sports up right now. Volleyball made a run. Just basically everybody. It's pretty impressive. Tennis, there we go. I don't want to leave anybody out just from looking at all these sports. So, yeah, of course. And Chris Del Conte, you know, he said on record, they want every program at Texas to be a top 10 program. And there's a lot of top one programs here this past semester.
Doing pretty darn good there. And we will talk more about the Texas baseball trip back to Omaha. Coming up next hour, we're going to take a break from that for just a few minutes because something happened over the weekend in sports that would have been our lead story today had it not been for the Longhorns making it back to Omaha. And that is what happened during the Euro Cup. Is this 2020 or 2021? I feel like
2020.
Okay. I keep
just
seeing,
like, the 2020 Olympics are this summer.
Yeah, very confusing. But it was a shocking event that happened near the end of the first half as Denmark and Finland were squaring off, where Denmark's best player, Christian Eriksen, is about to take a pass from an inbounds, and he just kind of stumbles and falls. And I guess I need to preface this by saying that I did not see this live. I had a friend, one of my buddies that I had played in the Mullet Open with the day before, text me and a mutual friend and say, "Oh my gosh, are you watching this soccer game right now? Somebody may have just died on the field." And so pretty quickly I try and catch up with what's going on. I'm with my family at the pool right now, but this is a big enough piece of news that I need to take a minute to try and figure out what's happening. End up seeing the replay, and you can see a lifelessness in his eyes when he hits the ground. And sure enough, that has been confirmed by the team doctor, who said, yeah, he was dead when he was on the field. We actually had to revive him back to life. But credit to the medical professionals who get onto the field, I want to say within a minute and a half, are doing CPR soon after that, and then they use a defibrillator, and it only takes one shock to actually get his heart beating and him breathing again. Could have been an enormous tragedy that may very well have canceled the rest of Euro Cup 2020, but instead, this match ends up getting resumed. Mm-hmm. It's postponed. It ends up getting resumed a couple hours later. May not have been the best decision, but they were able to do so because Christian Eriksen actually does come back to life. It's a truly remarkable story.
The best pictures out of all that was seeing him with his oxygen mask on and eyes open and sitting up and being and alive, of course. And I think you also have to, there's some praise due to the Finns and the Danes who made the wall around him to stop that scene. And I saw a lot of criticism, I think, of like ESPN and Univision, you know, the North American TV partners. They don't decide what gets shown on there. They're just getting the feed from UEFA, the governing body. So UEFA is the one that kind of needs to look in the mirror and wonder, should they be showing, you know, a man potentially dying on the pitch? That's something they need to think about. But it also kind of lets you know why, whenever you go to a high school game, whenever you go to any sort of game, that's why that ambulance is sitting in the corner of the end zone, because you never know. It could be a broken leg. It could be a broken finger. It could be a sprained shoulder. Could be cardiac arrest. And that's why they have medical professionals, you know, there ready, and also tremendous credit to those who saved Christian Eriksen's life.
And defibrillators are an incredibly important piece of technology.
So my mom used to be a school nurse, and it's one of those things where I think there is either a state law or city law in Houston, probably a state law, to where they defibrillators at a certain point, and I'll probably get a text from her in a minute, defibrillators at a certain point became required because of events like that, because it's literally a game of seconds. If you don't get that thing strapped to their chest and shocking them, this story could have been a lot more tragic. And that's why you have them there, you know, on location, on site, in order to be able to administer it as quickly as possible. And they're high tech too. It's not just like in the, you know, in the movies where they rub them together and the doctor yells clear and you put, it walks you, a lot of the smart ones, you know, you attach it to one side, attach it to, you know, so the shock goes from basically your shoulder to your hip, so it goes through your heart, and it kind of can tell, do I need to shock again? Don't touch them.
Wow.
Administer CPR. I've seen one of the dummy ones work before, and it's quite the piece of technology.
I spoke with a cardiologist a couple of months ago, and he said that the some of the best places to have a cardiac event are at a sporting event, at like a gym, or even, believe it or not, at a casino, because they are all well stocked with defibrillators, and they're defibrillators that can be gotten to pretty quickly as well. And so to your point, and what we got to see this weekend, I mean, that really is the difference, because the CPR wasn't doing it. That was not bringing him back to life. It was the shock that brought him back to life.
And it's not just sporting events. Your kids are school age, right?
Yep.
I'm sure at wherever they go to elementary school, somewhere in the hall, there's a big old box with an AED on it that if you open, it starts ringing like a fire alarm to let people know. And I think it's something required at schools now even too. So, you know, and I think they have them. If you walk around UT's campus, maybe there's some on there. It's been a while since I've been in some of the academic buildings there. But I think if you go to Gregory or if you go to the rec or anything that, they have them there. So it speaks to what the cardiologist was telling you about. I was
trying to think of events where we've actually seen something like that play out before. The only one that really came to my mind was Hank Gathers, and that was obviously not a widely watched event at the time. It was something that we did see the replays of, but thankfully we haven't had more things like this happen throughout a lot of our sports viewing lives.
And another thing that the pandemic brought, and if you remember last year, whether they should play argument,
myocarditis
was right, to where a lot more cardiac screening is now involved in these physicals. And you know, I think you get maybe not EKGs whenever you get a physical, or maybe with you know, Division I athletes you do, but there's a lot of, you know, heart screening and stuff like that in order to find out these issues before they become what we saw on the field.
Yeah, and a piece of news that came out a little bit earlier is that because valid questions were being asked, had he suffered from COVID? Had he received the vaccine? Because we're now seeing some cases of myocarditis pop up in the younger crowd that's getting vaccinated. Or was there some sort of other underlying issue? And the team doctor for Denmark did come out today and say, has not had COVID, has not received the vaccine yet, and we screened him literally, a couple of days ago before Euro 2020 got going, and nothing popped up, obviously, because otherwise he would not be out there. So hopefully doctors can figure out this mystery and discover why what happened on Saturday did.
Right. Sometimes there's really not a ton of explanation, which is kind of scary, but it is what it is.
All right, coming up, it is the Crap Bag. Chad's not here, but the Crap Bag lives on. So we're going to be talking a little bit of NBA with Zay behind the glass. He is our resident National Basketball League expert. I don't watch a ton of NBA, as you're all well aware. Joe watches a little bit more than me, but Zay is the guy to turn to. We want to find out about Chris Paul and the Phoenix Suns and whether the Clippers can come back and whether Philadelphia is in control of their respective series. We'll discuss all of that and more coming up here on Shirts and Skins on the Horn.
Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey.
Back here on Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. No Chad Hastings. He's on vacation. Joe Cook sitting across from me. All right, now helping co-host all the way up until 2 o'clock. From 2 to 3 today, we're going to take a break from the sports talk to bring you a conversation from my podcast, Books on Pod. I recently spoke with a guy named Ted Slingerland. He wrote a new book called Drunk, and it's essentially about why alcohol consumption has been important to our evolution. It's a fascinating conversation. Obviously, there is a fine line there between alcohol being a good social stimulus and something that can be very destructive. I enjoyed this chat and think you will as well. Check it out starting at 2 o'clock. Hey, Zay, real quick, before we hit the Crap Bag sounder, you played a couple different songs today. Is there any theme that we're going with today, or are you just doing your typical playing good music thing?
Typical Zay.
Typical Zay. All right, I like that. Speaking of typical Zay, we're about to get into some NBA talk in the Crap Bag.
Chad's Crap Bag.
Crap Bag. If you need an easy way to remember it, just think of a bag of crap.
set a baseline before we ask Zay questions about the series still going on and the team that has now moved on to the NBA semifinals or the conference finals, however you want to look at it. Joe, you probably watch more NBA than I do, but I don't know how much. I mean, how much NBA are you watching these days, considering that you are still having to cover Texas baseball and recruiting and everything else going on in your professional world?
Once James Harden won it out, I was like, you know what? I can do other things this season. And yeah. I was hoping that maybe the DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, and James Harden combo would they'd trudge through it and make it happen, but they didn't. So after that, I kind of just became a, you know what? Let's hope the Rockets lose as many games as possible and get Cade Cunningham. So
that's fair. All right, Zay. Yesterday's action in the NBA saw Milwaukee tie their series with Brooklyn and Phoenix flat out sweep Denver, which I did not think would happen. Even though Denver is down Jamal Murray, they've still played well enough without him to at least win a couple of games in this series, especially going back to Denver after losing the first two in Phoenix. But not only did it not happen, but the league's MVP gets ejected in that fourth and final game in the process. Now, I do want to get to that in just a second, but before we do, you were singing the praises of Phoenix when I was on with Bucky what would have been a week and a half ago, and they are still chugging along. Should we be looking at the Phoenix Suns as the team with the best chance to win the championship right now?
Oh, I don't know, because each round is different. I think matchups are so big in the NBA. I think if Phoenix runs into a certain matchup, maybe Utah when they're fully healthy, I think that will be a tough one for them. But at the end of the day, with all these injuries, Donovan Mitchell just got hurt. We saw what happened with Kyrie in Milwaukee. Phoenix is as healthy as anybody in the league, especially with Chris Paul. That showed there ain't nothing wrong with him. So, yeah, Phoenix, they're definitely looking like they could, you know, put that trophy up at the end of July.
So Chris Paul single-handedly outshoots Denver from mid-range in this four-game series. And it was impressive what he did throughout the series, but especially yesterday, not taking a single three-pointer and scoring as much as he did, as efficiently as he was, and also helping his teammates play better as well. I mean, this is a guy that really was cast off when he was leaving Houston. And, you know, people thought that he still had a little bit of juice left in the tank after a single season spent in Oklahoma City, but I don't think anybody expected this. Did you expect this, or is this a total shock to you as well?
Complete shock, because at the end of the day, Chris Paul's health has always been his Achilles heel, no pun intended. And, you know, he's just the guy that's always, you know, the best player on the team. No matter who's on the squad, he's always... Well, he might not be the best player this year because Devin Booker, that dude's pretty damn good. But he's always the most important player on the team. And, again, when he's healthy, he's just a top five point guard to me ever. You know, he's just a guy that gets it done on both ends. People talk about Kawhi Leonard being a two-way player. Chris Paul, other than John Stockton, might be the best. Well, Gary Payton, but might be one of the best two-way point guards to ever lace him up. And what he's done with the Suns this year, and clearly Devin Booker has been, you know, the man there for a long time, but obviously this year Chris Paul's got him over the hump.
Yeah, the thing that, you know, it's Suns and Jazz, so I'm kind of wondering, like, you know, Rudy Gobert is going to be there. He's going to be a presence for that team, and I'm just trying to figure out, you know, if Chris Paul being able to maybe draw him further and further away from the rim with that mid-range game is going to open things up, not just for Booker, but also for DeAndre Ayton, if that's going to be able to help his game out. And, you know, like you mentioned, Donovan Mitchell maybe not being 100% is a huge, huge factor in that series. But
how dinged up is Donovan Mitchell? Because if he's that dinged up, then all of a sudden you have to feel pretty good about the Clippers' chances to once again erase an 0-2 deficit.
That's the thing. He tried to play it off like he was good, you know, in the presser, which that's what you're supposed to do. You don't want to let the other team, you know, see you bleed. But, yeah, it did not look good the way he went down. And he missed basically the whole month of, May because of that injury. So that's one thing to for sure look at.
One thing I'm kind of curious about is I know Utah always has one of the best home court advantages. Those fans are – They're rabid, and I think that's kind of being generous for talking about Utah fans.
There's another R word that they've been described as this year, too.
Yeah, that's true. L.A., you know, it's not a Clippers town, but it's playoff basketball, and they'll get involved. And I'm kind of curious. It seems like Phoenix, we saw that video going around, Suns and four, that type of thing. I'm wondering, you know, if they're also a team that you maybe should respect. What is it, the Talking Stick Arena crowd or something like that, whatever casino sponsors them out there?
Yeah, this is the same fan base that poisoned Michael Jordan. They don't care about anything. And to what you were saying earlier, Joe, about, you know, bringing Rudy Gobert out and stuff, that's what you have to do. And you might show me love on this. I think that's one thing Jericho Sims is going to benefit from when he goes through this draft process, because that's what is getting exposed now in the playoffs. Big men who are slow-footed, that can't move laterally, that are switching out to these guards and players like Kevin Durant, who will just abuse them over and over again. Like we saw in the first round with what Luka was doing to Zubac until Tyronn Lue realized, okay, we can't play this guy. We're just going to go small. So guys like Jericho Sims that excel at that, that's why I think it's big for, you know, a player like him to stay in the draft.
It's amazing to me that Jericho Sims continues to barely even get second round looks, because he is so more NBA ready than either Jackson Hayes or Mo Bamba was after their single season here at Texas. And yeah, he doesn't have the freaky length, or I say the crazy athleticism for his size. He has really good athleticism, to your point, and it's actually functional athleticism to the basketball court as well. It's not just being able to run the court and catch a lob dunk. It's actually being able to get the ball in his hands from the three-point line and do something with it, to actually dribble it and make some moves to the basket.
You mentioned about maybe him not, Jericho, maybe not having size. I think he checks in at like 6'9", something like that. But with his athleticism, he plays 6'11".
Yeah.
He's jumping up there. He's hitting his head on the rim. And that's a guy who can also, as we saw a ton, he can defend multiple positions. So, that offense, it's gotten more polished over the course of his Texas career. It still has a lot more room to grow. But, yeah, he's a guy that definitely fits into the modern NBA. I don't know if I agree. He may be more ready than Jackson Hayes. But I think Mo Bamba's, I think he's a little bit more skilled than you were giving him credit for.
Mo Bamba?
Yeah, coming out of college.
Mo Bamba was more skilled than Jackson Hayes was, but he was nowhere close to NBA ready.
Right, I get that. But I also think that Mo was more skilled than Jericho coming out of college, too. Because Mo could, if he needed to, it wasn't very often, but if he needed to, he could step back and take some three-pointers.
Don't say, oh, gosh.
If he needed to.
That's one of my biggest gripes with basketball in 2021 is way too many big guys that shoot it from a 20-25% clip are stepping behind the three-point line occasionally and jacking it up.
Didn't Brooke Lopez basically refurbish his whole career by being able to start? Brooke Lopez, you know, he's, you know, 7-footer.
And you're right about that.
He rehabbed his whole career by adding a three-point game. Heck, PJ Tucker, he was a European journeyman, or not even European. He was a Japanese, Chinese league guy, and then he learns how to hit the corner three and also be, you know, a five position defender.
Yeah, PJ Tucker is impressive. And look, if Mo Bamba can put the work in that Lopez did, whatever the offseason was before he was shooting it in the mid-30s, fine. I'm a little bit more okay with Mo Bamba shooting three-pointers. But otherwise, that is a wasted possession for his Orlando Magic team, or whatever team he's on now. I don't even follow Mo Bamba any even more. Real quick, Zay, before we hit this break, I did want to ask your thoughts on Brooklyn-Milwaukee. Everybody assumed after those first two games, this series is over. The Greek Freak was being called very overrated Greek Freak come postseason time, because really the proof is in the pudding. He has not gotten it done in the postseason, even though his teams have had some high expectations. But here we are now after four games. Series is tied to two games apiece. Not only is James Harden still not ready to go from the injury he suffered in game one, but Kyrie suffers an ankle injury yesterday. It looks like he's probably going to have to miss some time, too. Has the tide turned now? Is this now the Bucks series to lose? Or do you think Kevin Durant is good enough to still help elevate the Nets to a series victory in an Eastern Conference Finals?
Yeah, it's not looking good for the Nets at all, and I think this might be it for them, especially if Kyrie's not there, because now you could focus in on Kevin Durant. And PJ Tucker, he's done a really good job on KD thus far, and especially yesterday. Once Kyrie went out, then they could start doubling Durant on those high screens, and like I said before, about, you know, he's just been abusing Brooke Lopez this whole series. So now he can't do that anymore because, you know, before you could help or you couldn't help off due to Joe Harris, Kyrie, Landry Shamet. You know, they got shooters all over the place and they're setting screens with Brett Brown, who's not a shooter. So now they got to change their whole philosophy again. So they already had to adapt because James Harden's not there. Now they got to adapt because Kyrie's not there. And, you know, Chris Middleton's playing a lot better. Now, you know, Drew Holiday has a mismatch because he doesn't have to worry about guarding Kyrie. So now he has way more energy on the offensive end. So, yeah, this is looking really good for the Bucks and not so good for the Brooklyn Nets.
Zay Collier behind the glass for us all week as Chad Hastings is out. And I have a rotating cavalcade of co-hosts helping me out all week. That starts with Joe Cook of Inside Texas. Has been with us in hour one. Will be with us in hour two as well. Coming up next, one of his Inside Texas friends will join us to talk about the big recruiting weekend for Longhorn football. That's Jerry Hamilton. Coming up next here on Shirts and Skins on the Horn.